All right, good morning. It is good to be together. I'm going to rearrange here just a little bit. Let's go ahead this morning and turn to your neighbor and say, "You, my friend, make Sunday mornings so much better." You and you and you. And that concludes our worship this morning. Hope you all take that message to heart, and it is good to be together. Let me dismiss the youngest among us. Thank you, Ruth. Confession, I told Brianna she could stay in here, but she said she might fall asleep. Ouch. That hurts a little. Let me invite us this morning. We're going to head to Matthew chapter 6 and verse 16. The words will be on the screen here next to me. We're continuing our journey through the Sermon on the Mount, right? What are considered to be the most significant teachings of Jesus. Before we get there, I want to do one quick step back, noting that the question came as to why at the end of the Jesus prayer, the prayer that Jesus taught, do we often say, "For thine," or "For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen." And yet that's not part of the actual text that we read. And so just a quick note about that. It is a doxology, doxa meaning glory or praise, logia meaning a word or an utterance, and so it's effectively a word of praise. It's an expression of praise. With that, the practice actually comes from ancient Jewish worship, where a prayer of praise, what is the Kaddish, is said at the kind of the end of each section of worship, kind of bringing each section to a close. And so even though we don't find the words here in this original text, what we do find is the early church adopting this Jewish practice. The earliest record we have of this is a document called the Didache, also called the Teaching of the 12 Apostles. This is from around the first century, and from Didache 8, we read a version of the prayer, and then it ends with, "For thine is the power and the glory forever and ever." And so again, while not part of the original text here in Matthew, it is very much part of the early church, right? Part of the communal sort of tradition, and so it carries on to you and me. With that today, Matthew 6 and 16, again, Jesus, he's up on the mountainside, he is teaching, his Talmudim have gathered around. It says, we read, "When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." Now, to get at this, and I'm going to kind of do another quick rewind here, because I think context matters. And I know some of this, for many of you that have been here week after week, this kind of gets repetitive, but I also think repetition is not a bad thing. And at the heart of this, really, the Sermon on the Mount is an invitation. Right? Jesus is inviting us. He's inviting them, and he's inviting us. He's inviting you and me. It's an invitation to a different way of doing life and relationships, which is really the very call of Jesus, right? To come follow me. It's not to bow your head, close your eyes, and say this prayer. I'm fine with bowing your head, closing your eyes, and saying this prayer. But Jesus' call was never that. It was always come follow me. Right, come follow me in this way, in this particular way of doing life and relationships. A way of life that flows out of the Torah. what we think of as the first five books of our Bibles. The Torah can also refer to the kind of the whole of the Tanakh, the Old Testament to you and me. But it flows out from the Torah, right? The Jesus backstory. We spent 2 years there. The Jesus backstory that is the Torah. And Jesus makes that very clear. Makes that very clear when he says, right, do not think I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. In our version, it's the Torah and the Nevi'im. Do not think I came to abolish, kataluo. Right, do not think I came to cancel, to do away with, to get rid of the Torah or the Nevi'im. He says, I did not come to cancel it. He says, I came to fulfill it, pleroo, meaning to uncover or to reveal or to express the deeper significance, the deeper meaning, the deeper understanding. In effect, to show us God's heart. It comes by way, he says, of righteousness, this path of righteousness. And then he goes on to say it's a righteousness that surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Again, not meaning do better or do more, but different, other than. In the words of the scholar R.T. France, it is a different concept of righteousness altogether, a different understanding of how we should live as the people of God. Right? What is this way of life, Jesus says, and he reaches back to the Torah, he reaches back to Mount Sinai, he reaches back to the two stones and the 10 words, right? And he speaks of murder, where it says, you shall not murder. And he says, absolutely, I'm down with that. Right? But to the religious elite of the day, if there was no dead body, fantastic, right? I'm righteous. And Jesus said, no. It goes far deeper than that. Right? It's not just about a dead body. It's that we would see the value and worth of every other as being made in the image of God. That we would see all others as image bearers of the living God. He goes on to speak of adultery. And again, to the Pharisee, to the religious elite, it would be, well, is there a naked body? No, then everything's okay. And Jesus said, no, it's more than that. It's that we would see beyond the labels that we use, right? And see the whole person. He goes on to speak of oaths and vows, right? That the words we use, the words we speak to and about one another, that matters. He goes on to speak of eyes and teeth, right? And again, yes, but the way that we handle and deal with our differences and our disagreements, Jesus says that matters. And then he says, above all of that is love. Love God, love your neighbor, love your enemy, right? Agape, ahava in Hebrew. What is a benevolence and a goodwill that seeks nothing but the highest good of the other? And Jesus says, above all, love. It's a way of life that then finds expression in what ancient Judaism calls the three great pillars, what are viewed as really central expressions of righteous living. They certainly were in that day. And by the time of Jesus, they were deeply embedded disciplines. These were practices that shaped the early church life. This first pillar we've talked about, almsgiving, right? Tzedakah, eleemosune, giving to the one in need, giving to those in need. And again, it's not if, right? But when you give. And then the second pillar, prayer, again, not if you pray, but when you pray. So be a people who pray, right? Again, not a prayer of belief, but it's a prayer of action. And now today we come to the third pillar, the third discipline, the third practice. Jesus, again, not if, he says, not if, but when you fast. Now to get behind this, there is one fast and only one fast that is prescribed by the Torah. the Jesus backstory that is the Torah. It's from Leviticus or Vayikra, if you're Hebrew, from that section called Parsha Aharimot. 16 and 29, it says, we read, "This is to be a lasting ordinance for you. On the 10th day of the 7th month," and so this is just once a year, this is the only Torah-mandated fast, once each year. And then we read, "Ve'enitem et nafshotehem," you must afflict yourselves. Some translations say you must deny yourselves. "And not do any work, whether native-born or a foreigner residing among you, because on this day, atonement will be made for you. It is a day of Sabbath rest, and you must," and then here again, we read, "afflict yourselves or deny yourselves." And again, it is a lasting ordinance. Now, interesting, the Hebrew word for fast is tzom. It's not used here, but probably both ancient and modern Judaism have long understood the meaning here of to afflict or to deny as all about abstaining. So it's not the word fast, but it's been clearly understood that this is about abstaining, not only from food and drink, but very early on, that it was a laying aside of all kinds of ordinary comforts and pleasures. Noting again that this is not daily or weekly or monthly, but it was yearly. Now, over time, that changed. That changed quite a bit. Fasting multiplied. We read in Judges 20 and 26, "Then all the Israelites, the whole army, went up to Bethel. There they sat weeping before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord." 1 Samuel 7, 6, "When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted and confessed, 'We have sinned against the Lord.'" Nehemiah chapter 9, opening line, "On the 24th day of the same month, the Israelites gathered together, fasting and wearing sackcloth and putting dust on their heads." With that, there was great use of private fasting. We read from the Testament of Reuben being a brother of Joseph, and remember last week we talked about Joseph and the forgiveness of his brothers, "Come close to me," and all of that. You can go back and listen online. But here it speaks of Reuben fasting for 7 years because of his part in the selling of his brother into slavery. From 1 and 10, "He drank no wine or other liquor, no flesh passed his lips, and he ate no appetizing food." In the same way, we read, "Simeon afflicted his soul with fasting for 2 years because he had hated Joseph. Repenting of his sin with Tamar, it's told that Judah, even to old age, took neither wine nor flesh and saw no pleasure." Now again, over the years, fasting became far more prevalent, and by Jesus' day, it was the religious elite, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law and the religious elite, who were now fasting twice a week. And with that, it soon became customary to hold public fast days on Mondays and Thursdays, and that was because those were market days. And so you would have a large number of people out in public in the towns and the villages. And so as the scholar William Barclay notes, you would have those who walked through the streets with hair deliberately unkempt and disheveled, with clothes deliberately soiled and disarrayed. The result was that those who were ostentatiously fasting would on those days have a bigger audience to see and admire their piety. And it's into that reality, right, that here comes Jesus stepping into a world where there is one Torah-mandated fast that has now grown into a multitude, all for the sake of performance. All for the sake of performance, where righteousness has become reputation and devotion has become display. And he drives home this idea that fasting is intended not for, he says, somber expression and the disfiguring of faces, not for, as Barclay puts it, disheveled hair, dirty faces, soiled pants, all in disarray, but rather to deepen and to strengthen, right, our appreciation and our gratitude, our thankfulness for all of God's goodness. Are you with me? Right, to release us, in a sense, to release us from our attachments and thereby to free us, right, to be more open to receive what God has for us, the goodness of God, the gifts of God. In fact, there's this ancient rabbinic saying, a person will have to give an account on the judgment day for every good thing which one might have enjoyed and yet did not. In the words of Berkeley, he says, it is our duty to accept and enjoy the world's loveliness and not to reject it. There is no religious value in fasting undertaken for its own sake or as an ostentatious demonstration of superior piety. It may be that nowadays the appetite is blunted, the palate is dulled, the edge has gone off it. What was once a sharp pleasure has become simply a drug we cannot do without. Fasting keeps the thrill in pleasure by keeping pleasure always fresh and new. In a word, we could say this. We could say fasting is about getting the good in. Right? Fasting is about getting the good in, about enjoying the goodness of God's creation. As we read from the hymn, My God, I Thank Thee, third verse, it says this. It says, so that earth's bliss may be our guide and not our chain. And so with that, I want to invite us to sit for a little bit and to consider what practice of fasting might God be leading me into? What practice of fasting might God be leading me into? Keeping in mind again, in Hebrew, by the time of the prophets, and certainly by Jesus' time, it was understood that, right, this is not just referring to food and drink, but this was the laying aside of all, right, of all the ordinary sorts of comforts and pleasures. And so what practice of fasting might God be leading me into? And maybe it is food, maybe it is drink. We could add media, certainly social media, maybe busyness, right? Think about habits and patterns, routines. You could ask it this way, what might you abstain from today, this week, this month? What might you abstain from? And then how about what in my life might God be asking me to release for a season? What in my life might God be asking me to release? We could borrow from Berkeley here and ask the question, where is my appetite blunted? In what way is my palate dulled? What is that thing I can't imagine doing without? Right, to loosen our attachments and free us to receive all that God has, all the beauty and the wonder and the delight. Now with that, there's one more piece here as we bring this to a close, noting that while yes, fasting is personal, it is also relational. And while, yes, it's absolutely about getting the good in, right, getting the good in me, it's also about getting the good in us. We catch this, I think, from Isaiah 58 and verse 5. We read this, is this the kind of fast I have chosen, only a day for people to humble themselves? Is it only for bowing one's heart like a reed and for lying in sackcloth and ashes? Is that what you call a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? And then here it is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice, untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? Right? Is it not to, when you see the naked, to clothe them? And not to turn away from your own flesh and blood? Point being, fasting is not just about me. Right? It's about us. It's about the other. Right? About getting the good in me, absolutely. And it's about getting the good in the other. It's about getting the good in us. And so maybe I fast from television, right? So that I have more time to connect with another. Maybe I fast from eating out so that I can step into the gap of food insecurity for the one who is hungry. Maybe I fast from social media so that I can create space to sit with one who is hurting. Maybe I fast from, not real sure how this would go about, but maybe I fast from my bias and my prejudice so that I can be open to a new understanding of and compassion. Maybe I fast from what I think is right so that I can be open to learning something new, right? And maybe, just maybe, I will not only get the good in me, but I will get the good in us. And so maybe we could close with what fast could open me to greater compassion. What fast might free me to love more deeply. Right, and maybe, just maybe. So when you fast,